Hello and welcome to the AFPAC File, a bi-weekly joint podcast of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty and the Wilson Center focusing on Pakistan in Afghanistan. I am Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager here in Washington, D.C. After numerous delays, Afghanistan is finally headed to a highly crucial parliamentary elections amid security concerns in a highly polarized environment where regional and ethnic politics are factors dominating today's political scene. So what is at stake in this election? To discuss this, I'm joined by Amin Mudaqiq, former bureau chief of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Afghan service in Kabul, who is currently heads Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Pashto service focused on Pakistan's tribal region. Amin is currently in Kabul. Kate Clark is joining us today from London, but she is usually in Kabul, where she works as the co-director of one of the few independent think tanks called Afghan Analysis Network. Omar Samet, former Afghan ambassador to France and Canada, is joining us from Washington, D.C., along Michael Kugelman, who is the deputy director of the Wilson Center's South Asia program. Welcome on board, colleagues.
Hello.
Good to be here.
Very nice to have you. So, Amin, please set the scene for us. How things are headed forward as few days left to the polling day?
Well, as I am in Kabul, I will describe the situation.
I mean, I think we have trouble with the connection. Your voices are breaking.
Would you like me to set the scene as I've just
been there? I think let's do that, Kate.
This is a strange election because where it's happening, there is a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm from candidates, a lot of activities, posters going up. But as soon as you get beyond the places that are secure, the election really stops happening. I was just recently in both Kabul and the northwest province of Faryab. And in Faryab, Maimana City, the provincial capital, was absolutely buzzing. But we couldn't even drive 20 minutes out of the city centre. And that's the problem. In Faryab, two-thirds of the province is either controlled or influenced by the Taliban, and people couldn't even register to vote. So you've got really, really concentrated activity and then nothing much. So some people are feeling rather disenfranchised because they won't be able to vote. Others are proceeding with enthusiasm.
Omar, I'm sure you are in connection with your contacts in Kabul. So what's your thought on this?
Well, I sort of agree with Kate's assessment, but I would add that you have three different groups of people in Afghanistan, eligible voters, potential voters. You have those who are enthusiastic. They obviously have their own reasons for being enthusiastic, and they are mostly supported by, well-oiled organizations or parties or individuals or interest groups within and outside government. Then you have those who feel disenfranchised, and they have no way to access the political system for different reasons, security being the main one, but also because they have either had problems registering, or the centers have problems, or there are rural issues, access issues, so on and so forth. Then you have those who, I think, the third group that we don't talk too much about, but I believe does exist, and maybe in the millions, who have on purpose decided not to take part, even though they could potentially. And they probably are the ones who, by not voting, are sending a message that they are dissatisfied with what is happening. I think they're dissatisfied with the fact that reforms have been very slow or non-existent or not focused enough, that this is maybe a repeat of what we have seen since 2005. And so you have these three different constituencies in the country, even though you see that the media is covering this with a lot of energy, and that some of the candidates, especially in the larger cities and the larger towns, are very active.
Mike, let me take your point on this. What's at stake here in this election when you look into this from Washington?
Sure. Well, I think that it's important to highlight several things here. First off, one is that these parliamentary elections had already been delayed, and so the effort to try to finally have them occur now, as was noted before, there are significant concerns about security, particularly in light of the fact that the Taliban has explicitly threatened to stage attacks on the polls. But, you know, I think to try to look at this in a positive way, you know, we're just a few days away from this election, and yet the government, at least so far, has given no indication that it's going to postpone them once again. I mean, there are plenty of analysts out there that had thought some months ago that there was no way it would be October, 13th, and, you know, in a position to say, well, the elections are at least now going to happen. So that's sort of trying to put a bit of a positive spin on this. But I think in terms of what's at stake, I think there's a significant amount at stake. I think it's true that these elections are not as consequential as the one scheduled for next year, the presidential election, for obvious reasons. But I do think that, you know, these elections are important because if they take place, clearly it would be a major morale boost for Afghanistan. It would be an indication that something as significant like this can actually occur. And it would also, I think, be the start of an important process of political transition, which needs to happen in Afghanistan as we move toward the presidential election next year. And I think that from the perspective of Washington, which is very fixated right now on this issue of trying to figure out a way to start a process, you know, the idea is to have a partner in Afghanistan, a government partner that's seen as credible, has the support of the Afghan people, is seen as legitimate, credible, so on. And I think that in that sense, you need to start with the process to bring in a new government that would where you could check off all those boxes. And then you have to start with these parliamentary elections. So in that sense, it is important.
It is important, obviously. Also, earlier, Kate, you also mentioned this in terms of the legitimacy. Like in Kabul, you see this buzz, and also you mentioned the buzz in Maimana, in Faryab, for example. But when you go outside the city, as you mentioned, like it seems nothing is really happening in terms of elections. So will this raise a question of legitimacy going forward?
Kate? Yeah, and I think there are two issues here. One, of course, is the individual Afghans who are disenfranchised. And I do take Omar's point that some of them actually really don't want to participate because they've lost faith in the process and in the government. But many may want to have taken part in these elections and not able to, and they are individually disenfranchised. Then you get to the issue in Afghanistan, maybe within the province, but more importantly within the country, when you're voting for the president next year, where it's basically one person, one vote, and the president is the person with the most votes, is that when security effectively disenfranchises whole groups of people, they may not get a place sort of in the bargaining for positions and power at the centre. So again, just to return to Faryab, which is Uzbek majority, they've lost probably tens, if not hundreds of thousands of voters this time. And they do feel that when it comes to the negotiating for the presidential ticket next time, their community will suffer. Huh. And that sort of feeling that people are being excluded from the centre is familiar from various parts of Afghanistan. And that's not good for the sort of, you know, the feeling that everyone is included in the state.
Hmm. Is that the situation only with Faryab, or you have similar scenarios taking place everywhere? Let's talk about South, for instance.
Yeah, well, we've already seen it in Ghazni, which is the main province, one of the main provinces on the way from Kabul to Kandahar. The elections are not taking place there at all. They've been postponed till next year. And that was partly because last time, basically within Ghazni, you have different ethnic groups, and the fighting has largely been in the districts where Pashtuns live. And in the last election, you saw a district which is mixed ethnically return MPs from only one ethnic group, the Hazaras. And that was basically because, A, they were very organized, but B, they were living in secure districts. So you can see that on one scale in the province, but there will be other places where, you know, a large number can't vote. And if we look at the provinces are different. Mm. I think Farah, if I'm not mistaken, had the least number of voters registered compared to the eligible voters. And then in other places, you've got, you know, very, very high numbers.
Well, can I just say and give you a number which is staggering, which is that they're estimating that 2,300 and something polling stations out of 7,300 or 400 polling stations will be closed on election day.
Yeah, that's a third.
That's a third of all polling stations across Afghanistan will be closed, mainly because of security conditions.
And those polling stations which are expected to be closed, mainly where they are? Which part of the country?
There are obviously in areas where it's contested or under Taliban control, or where security for local reasons is threatened, or for whatever other reasons there's no access to polling centers, or no polling centers or stations have been set up. So it's a mix of reasons, but the main reason obviously is control and security.
Hmm. So what the
just to let the listeners know, the top worst provinces, that these are all provinces that have got less than 40% of the eligible voters managing to register. So that's Farah, that's southwest, Badghis, that's northwest, Kunar in the east, Uruzgan south, and Kunduz in the north. And Faryab in the northwest. So it's spread around the country. But you've got significant numbers of Afghans who, even if they want to, cannot participate in this election.
Still, it's a positive development that indeed these elections are taking place. But still, given this polling stations, one third of them might be closed and there are security problems which might prevent people from voting, exercising their right. So what would the consequences of this situation might be going forward for the political process, let's say, to the presidential elections?
This is sort of a pilot, a mini pilot for presidential elections in terms of technicality as well, because of this biometric system that has been brought in at the last minute is being tested. And so we don't even know how accurate it will be. And we do know that it will not be online. It will not be real time, which is a huge, obviously, setback. But I think that the issues that are very important on one hand is that there was sort of pressure from within and especially from outside Afghanistan that these elections should be held, even though security is an issue, technicalities are issues, preparations were not adequate enough. There was a need for more time to spend on reforms, on certain critical pieces of reform that were pledged. That was not totally fully done. Despite all of this, the pressure was that we need to go ahead for the sake of showing that there is political movement and momentum in Afghanistan. There's a transition coming up, as was mentioned. And also that stability, and legitimacy are important factors for Afghanistan moving forward. Also, there's one very interesting point that was made by the international community is that next month, there's supposed to be a conference on Afghanistan in Geneva. It's called the Geneva Ministerial Conference, which is going to look at how the money has been spent and how the international engagement in terms of social and economic development is shaping up. And nobody wanted to say, well, elections were not held before this because it would have looked pretty bad. And so they wanted to make sure that the picture, at least the image, looks positive.
So just to look into this activities on the ground. So who are the prominent figures in the election scene, Kate?
Many of the sitting MPs are re-standing. Some of them are actually not standing in their home provinces because of security. Someone like Kabul province has got 800 candidates. Imagine opening your ballot paper and finding 800 names, particularly if you're illiterate or you're a bit weak in reading. So you've got sitting MPs. You've got a number of mainly sons, it has to be said, of former commanders and warlords who are now coming of age and representing the family. You've also got a number of business people, and you've got a number of what I would say are enthusiastic young people, quite a lot of journalists. So it's a mixed bag. Being an MP in Afghanistan enables you, if you wish, to become rather rich. It's a good position to be in if you want to, help people get jobs in response for money. The MPs in recent years have got what are actually openly referred to as MPs contracts in the budget. So these are development contracts that MPs have managed to, certain MPs have managed to get, and they will open for bidding. So they make money on bidding for government contracts. In the past, we've also had certain MPs who've enabled their constituents to get security detainees released. So it's a place to go where you can make money if that's your intention. And that means that quite a lot of the sitting MPs, as well as others, are rich. And this may also skew the vote. So trying to appeal to voters on a sort of normal democratic way is just one of the ways in which you might get elected in Afghanistan. Another is using money. And another, of course, is trying to use fraud. And one of the problems with having an insecure country is that fraud, things like filling ballots with fake ballot papers, is easier in areas that are insecure because you have fewer observers and fewer independent observers and candidates' agents.
I was also looking into the list of candidates who are running for the office from Kabul. It's just enormous. It's just enormous. So what are some of the other challenges, Omar, that Afghans will face?
I mean, obviously representation is very important. Mm. I mean, an election is supposed to provide the population and the eligible voters the means to be represented and their voice be heard within a parliament or legislature. And these people are supposed to be legislators, which means that they have to deal with laws and they have to deal with laws that then impact policy or vice versa. You know, they have to endorse a cabinet. So they have certain rights and certain privileges and certain authority. And obviously not everybody is qualified, let's say. There are very few qualification parameters. And you see some interesting characters who end up being on the candidate list, including someone who still is in prison, for example, and people who have shady pasts or belong to networks that may have ulterior motives. So this is Afghanistan today. And I think that what we are seeing is also a new crop of Afghans, as Kate mentioned, who want to maybe play by the rules and maybe bring some reform. I'm hoping that some of the more independent-minded young Afghans, educated Afghans, who mean well and whose sole purpose is not to enrich themselves, can get into parliament and make a difference and offer a good role model for others to come. You know, the past few years have not offered us too many good role models, even though there were some good MPs in the past, but many have left or many were dissatisfied. That's one of the challenges. You know, you also want to make sure that you have enough women in parliament. In Kabul, unfortunately, out of the 800, only 13 or 14% are women, which in itself means that there is an underrepresentation. And there's one Sikh from a religious minority who has been allowed to run. And not everybody, you know, again, education being an issue, you know, having enough knowledge. But we still have 40% of Kabul's candidates who are above the age of 45. And we do need experienced people as well. It doesn't mean that everybody has to be in their 20s to be in parliament. Yeah. So these are some of the issues, I think, moving forward. But the most important thing on people's mind is how transparent this election is going to be, how credible it's going to be at the end of the day, with all the challenges that everybody knows exist, and what kind of next step is going to develop and evolve out of this election, going towards presidential elections, especially at a time when there's a lot of talk about making peace, and how is that going to connect to the political process that's in place. And there are a lot of big questions that Afghans will face over the next year.
Maybe there is nothing really major behind this, but when I was looking into the candidates list from Kabul, I have seen majority of them were running on independent platforms. Does it say anything, Kate?
Yeah, well, the Afghan system was deliberately designed to hinder parties from organizing. So most candidates run as independents. And it makes for a very, it's very difficult to organize elections, but very difficult to organize parliament. So you've basically got, the MPs are basically individuals. I mean, there are some sort of caucuses within the parliament, but they are easily breaking away. It makes for a very, very complicated political system.
Yeah. Michael, you are kind of quiet today. Talking of the platforms, earlier when there was discussion taking place between Hikmatyar and Afghan government, what role Hikmatyar is playing or some other parties are playing in this election, although we have seen enormous numbers of independents running for the office?
Well, you know, Mohammed, that's a good question. But first, I think I'll go back to just highlighting some of what we've heard over the last few minutes, which is important. And I've been doing a lot of listening. You're right. You know, Kate and Omar, I think, very eloquently have laid out what to me seem to be some very considerable, not necessarily obstacles, but concerns about this election. You know, one being access issues, security concerns, making it hard for people to vote if they want to, turnout issues rooted in a concern that are rooted in, you know, voter apathy or simply a desire not to vote, technology, the fact that concerns about not being having the proper equipment, with including these biometric voting machines. And to me, you know, that raises sort of an interesting question. You know, I said earlier that if these elections do take place, it would be a big triumph for the country. It would be a big morale boost and all. But if the elections do take place, theoretically, and yet they're marred by, you know, concerns about turnout or, you know, fraud or whatever the case may be, you know, what does that mean in terms of the optics of the election? Will that essentially lead to people, including critics of the government, specifically critics of President Ghani, to try to exploit what had just happened and try to bring that into this ongoing narrative about a lack of political legitimacy in Afghanistan right now, as it's evinced by the current government. So, and that then has implications for, you know, the presidential election, which will mean that the stakes will rise even more. And I think that what Omar said before was true, that this is sort of like a test case. I mean, seeing how this goes, where there's not as much at stake as there is with the presidential election next year, you know, that's very significant. And, you know, I think that, again, we're just a few days away. We have no reason to think that things won't, that the election won't happen. But even if it does, clearly there's going to be a lot of concerns and questions that arise from this election, which could give ammunition, so to speak, to critics of the president, who have really been quite active and vocal over the last few years, and particularly over the last few weeks.
You are right. Kit, what are some of the major issues that are on the ballot?
I don't actually know, and maybe Omar does. I mean, the slogan, it's quite difficult to navigate. You can imagine trying to work out the main slogans of 800 candidates just in Kabul, for example, when they're not differentiated by party platforms. And you tend to get quite a lot of bland slogans. So, you know, pro-Afghanistan, pro-stability. And it can actually be quite difficult to distinguish people. I don't know if Omar or Amin have had any better luck than me.
I have tried to follow. If I were to give an Afghan, typical Afghan answer, I would say that there are 2,500 candidates and 2,501 platforms. So, and slogans. So that's how maybe widespread it is and diverse it may be. But what I've heard from many, especially on the reformist side, is their focus on a couple of issues that sort of are very localized. One is anti-corruption and reform. And so there are those who want to brand themselves as real reformists, as opposed to previously, you know, previous people who used to claim to be reformists and didn't turn out to be reformists. And then you have those who are talking to people about poverty and about jobs and about better livelihoods. And then there are those, obviously, who talk about security and they talk about peace and reconciliation. But that number is low because that is a very sensitive issue and one that is right now in progress, work in progress. So I think what you have is that kind of array of issues, mostly local, with the economy, jobs, and corruption as being the top platforms.
I don't know if Amin is still with us. Amin, are you with us? I don't hear him. So I was talking to Amin earlier. He also mentioned a couple of other points, I think, which is really relevant to this part of the discussion. Besides slogans and all these things, there are certain alliances. There are certain groupings based on regional cards, ethnic cards, reformist and conservative. How this thing is playing out, I believe it's very important when you talk about Afghanistan. Kate?
Yeah. I mean, in the absence of political parties and in a system like Afghanistan, where having a patron is really important for getting a job or for getting a contract, those sort of vertical economic relationships are really important. So I think the fallback position for Afghan politics has unfortunately tended to be ethnic, and it's proved quite difficult. I think some people have tried to get around that, but it's proved quite difficult to get a system that where people don't vote on ethnic grounds. You see that very clearly in the presidential election, but even in the parliamentary as well. And that might be, I mean, let's say ethnic and tribal. Strangely, though, I don't know if this is echoed by other participants, but for example, we've got one seat in parliament that's reserved for the Sikh Sikhs and Hindus. They're a minority in Afghanistan. And I encountered a lot of people in Kabul who said they would gladly vote for the Sikh. It's actually a Sikh man who's standing because they felt he wouldn't be corrupt. So there's this real pull to try and get your, you know, get a person in parliament or in the presidential palace that is from your group. But at the same time, there's a real disillusionment with that sort of politics and no real way out to no practical alternative to try and get your voice heard, at least not one that's become evident yet. Maybe we will see that.
Very interesting. So this was about the political activism. Now, what are some of the striking points compared to the previous election? And what does those points tell us about the outcome of the elections in the bigger picture about the future of Afghan government? We will continue our pack file talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today I am joined by Kate Clark, co-director of Afghanistan Analysis Network, Omar Samad, former Afghan ambassador, currently in Washington, D.C., Michael Kugelman, senior South Asia analyst with the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. I am Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, South and Central Asia media manager, and we are discussing upcoming parliamentary elections in Afghanistan. So let's dive deep a little bit in some of the points we have been discussing earlier, Kate. Compared to the previous elections, what are some of the striking points that you have came across so far?
Well, I guess there's two things. One, given all the upset about the last presidential elections and the fraudulent voting that went on and the insistence that there had to be reform, I think one of the key things is that there's been almost no reform. So we've almost, I mean, there's a few minor things. This time you are registered to vote at a particular polling centre. But I think apart from that, there's almost been no changes in the system. You know, the problems that Afghans have faced getting a clean vote, they face the same issue again. I think that's one thing. Secondly, the Taliban just control a lot more of the country than they did in 2010 or even 2014. And the polling will be much more limited because of that. And indeed, I mean, if you look at what the Taliban are saying, for them, you know, keeping turnout and keeping voting to a minimum is what they're aiming at.
Omar, your thoughts on that? Like comparison, the way this process is taking place?
Yeah, I agree that security is worse now than it was before. There's more uncertainty across the board. There is a larger protest vote, I think, that of people who will not vote. We don't have exact numbers, the accurate numbers as to how many people really registered. A number has been given, but nobody believes it, I think. On the other hand, I also see some positive changes or in contrast. I see more young people being involved, more reform-minded people being involved. I see an amazing display of social media skills and the use of social media for campaigning and for getting your picture and your word and your videos out. And that in itself has created quite a buzz and has gotten a lot of people involved, positively and negatively. And traditional media, TV, radio also is playing, I think, a bigger role these days and giving a platform for candidates to express themselves more than I've seen ever before in the past. We unfortunately didn't have enough reforms on time. Hopefully this will be a lesson for everyone and that we won't waste time, you know, 4 years now and previous years as well, trying to fix the system. And I think there's going to be a big question at the end of the day as to whether the so-called SNTV system, the single non-transferable voting system, is the best for Afghanistan and how to move the country toward more established, more professional political party system in the future. These are questions that may come up in the midst of what's happening today.
All right. So, Michael, let me take also your point on this before moving on to the other notes.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the others have said, but I would just add and go back to what I had mentioned earlier, looking at one of the really big, big picture issues here, and that's that, you know, this very intense move to try to launch some type of peace process, for, even though that still is probably quite some time off. I mean, you know, we had that period, that very brief truce that the Taliban agreed to some months ago, and then we have this arrangement now where Kabul has signed off on, has essentially signed off on the U.S. talking directly to the Taliban, which of course has always been one of the main stated preconditions of the Taliban for its agreeing to participate in talks. So you could argue that there's a fair amount of momentum right now for some type of big push to launch a peace process. So that suggests that you know, there's a lot at stake in the sense that as you move or as you hope to move toward the start of a peace process, if one could start, you really need to have a sense of, you know, who the big players are, you know, what the government is going to look like in Afghanistan, all the other key stakeholders involved. And you know, it's a lot easier to make those judgments and to move forward when you've had a political transition begin. And again, this I see these elections, these parliamentary elections, as the first process of first step of what will be a pretty long and messy and probably bumpy political transition process. So I see that as one of the things that really is quite different now from the last time around.
Is that a factor in the elections, Kate, like the peace process? What do you hear from the slogans of the candidates?
Yeah, I think it'll be more of a factor in the presidential election.
Ah, okay. You're talking about the presidential elections. So though Abdullah Noor Ghani is part of this process, but again, what this election also might mean for their future?
I mean, the way that Afghanistan works is MPs sort of have few responsibilities and quite strong powers. So they have to vote in ministers, and they can also summon ministers and sack them. They have to vote on the budget. There's various other things that they're able to do in which they can hold the government to account, or, as is always alleged, they are ready to sell their votes to the government. So who gets to be in parliament is actually quite important for the executive, because they need MPs on side who will vote with them.
Yeah. Are they playing any role? Like, my question, I think, is like how, you know, these two guys, Abdullah and Ghani, how they relate to the elections. Omar, maybe you want to jump in here?
Well, I mean, directly, obviously, they do not.
Yeah.
But like in any other election, the executive branch, let's say, has sway and has influence over certain matters, and they would like to use it indirectly. I think that this particular election is going to be very telling about how the main political actors, whether they're individuals or networks or patronages or political parties or alliances and coalitions, are trying to influence events down the road, whether it's the presidential election or whether it's peacemaking or other high-level issues that Afghanistan is facing, how they want to influence it through parliament, the two houses of parliament, the two houses of the assembly, lower and upper house. And I think this time around, you see that there is a concerted effort by all the power brokers to have a say and to influence the next parliament. The hope is that it will be positive, it will be constructive, and it will be less corrupt than it was in the past.
Michael, as a result of this, the entire process, so what kind of parliament you are expecting to see?
Well, you know, it's hard to say, and here I would defer to the other to our other guests to give a better sense of that. But you know, I think for me, as someone who's sitting here in Washington, who tries to look at the big picture, the important thing is not as much what the parliament will look like. Obviously, that's important as well, but how it will be perceived and what the response will be from, you know, key critics of the government, including those within the government, within the National Unity Government. You know, how is this election perceived? Is it seen as sufficiently credible, sufficiently successful to sort of take the heat off the, you know, the president, so to speak? Would it be sufficiently bad that you have to worry about you know, this narrative of an illegitimate government coming into play once again? I think that'll be a big thing to look forward to, a thing to look to as we move forward in the next few months toward the presidential election, which is obviously much more consequential. And then if you have this build up leading up to that, then you know, there'll be so much more at stake, and that could really be significant as we get closer to that election.
Yeah, it's kind of a speculative question. Kate, what is your expectations, you know, in terms of the outcome of this election? Who has more chances of being a majority? What kind of policies you expect to see?
Well, just remember that it's not to do even primarily with popularity. Money and, I'm sure in some places, vote rigging will come into play. And in the last parliament, it's a little bit too an exaggeration to say it was a den of thieves, but it's not that far out. I mean, MPs rarely had a quorum even to decide on legislation or matters of the day. People turned up for big votes. MPs turned up for big votes. So if they were summoning a minister to answer or if they were voting on a cabinet position. But most of the time, they didn't bother to come to work. I mean, the parliament is a place where you can make money if that's what you want to do. And I would suggest that a lot of the sitting MPs were bent on doing that. It's a great place to make money. Now, if that is to shift, there would need to be something seismic in the Afghan political situation. I'm hoping it's going to be better, but you still have to be aware that, you know, in many places, the local strongman is running for parliament and it's very difficult to go against him. And this will be even in place, you know, even in Kabul province. There were attempts so officially, if you've got links to armed groups, you can't run for parliament. And the election commissions did exclude 20 people, but the process was not transparent. And some of the people on the list were questionable. And there were a lot of people who should have been excluded who are not, who are, you know, clearly have access to armed men, some of them, you know, running big criminal enterprises, who were in the last parliament and will be undoubtedly in the next one. So, you know, the poor Afghan voter trying to navigate that whole system when they don't even have political parties to guide them. As I said, I'm hoping this parliament will be better because you've got at least some energy, some commitment, some people who really, I would be very surprised if they won their seats and they turned corrupt. But I think it's despite the system if we get some better MPs, not because of it.
Omar, so final points from you. So what are the elements you will be looking at to judge the election process and its outcome?
Well, I think this is going to be a comparative look at whether we are doing better this time versus last time or not in terms of turnout, in terms of rigging, is it less or more, in terms of results accepted or not, to what extent, in terms of new fresh minds and new thinking, new blood and better blood, hopefully, in the new parliament versus the last one. And also, at the end of the day, what lessons have we learned from the past almost 13 years of having this system in place? And are we going to apply those lessons? And are we going to reconnect the Afghan people to the political system that has been put in place, knowing that there are a lot of big issues coming up in terms of, you know, overtures to the Taliban, you know, maybe in the presidential elections? Stability overall, I think, at the end of the day, will matter.
Okay, Michael, just a very quick note from you. So as Afghans are going to polls in a couple of days, what will you be looking at?
Well, see, I'll leave this on a positive note. I think we need more good news stories from Afghanistan, right? I mean, again, the fact that we're talking about people going to the polls in a few days, you know, some months ago, plenty of folks were saying that these elections were not going to take place, that they were going to be folded into the presidential ones next year, and that would have gotten very messy. So let's leave it at that. You know, there's certainly a lot of reasons to be concerned, but you know, the fact of the matter is it seems like they're going to happen, warts and all, so to speak. And I think that's something that we should be highlighting, given that there's so much bad news coming out of Afghanistan these days.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank Kugelman, you.
South Asia analyst with the Wilson Center. Big thanks goes to Kate Clark, co-director of Afghanistan Analysts Network, and Omar Samet, former Afghan ambassador. Thank you very much, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today.
A pleasure.
Thank you. And Amin Mudakik, who could not make to the discussion because of difficulties, also big thanks goes to him. So this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the AFPAC File, a joint podcast of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and the Wilson Center. Please join us in the next discussion in 2 weeks. Until then, bye-bye.